The ways in which contemporary society considers what could be called applied or professional ethics is the result of histories of transgression, some of which have resulted in previously conservative conceptions and practices being changed and opened up, others which have caused the community to go never again. In medicine, we have the Nuremberg Code, a set of research ethics principles for working with human subjects, which was developed in the aftermath of World War II. Principles of informed consent and ethical oversight were further refined in New Zealand as a result of the Cartwright Inquiry. In sociology, people point to Stanley Milgram's experiments on obedience to authority and Loud Humphrey's covert research into cottaging as pivotal moments to which the profession reacted and changed. Performance has its own pivotal moments. Instances such as Marina Abramovich's Rhythm O and John Duncan's Blind Date, which show us the edges of performance and what we are willing to do or accept being done. Chris Braddock, Mark Jackson, David Cross, Sean Curran, Mark Harvey, Sally J. Morgan and Alexa Wilson discuss some of these performances. They are joined by Hadley Avril, whose art school performance with Panya Lincoln had a lasting impact on the audience and the institution.
Can I use a historical example?
Yes, absolutely.
Chris Burton. So Chris Burton's shoot, and there's this essay by Christine Stiles, and she paints this picture of Chris Burton, and he does this performance, I think, while he's at art school, and there's an audience there, and he orchestrates being shot in the arm. And so he lines up, he has a friend who's a marksman with a rifle. And the audience stands by. We don't really see that many photographs of the audience in the documentation, but he's shot in the arm. And the iconic photograph that remains from that performance is the shot of Chris Booth. Chris Burden, as he holds his arm with the bullet hole through it, the top of his arm around the back of the bicep. And you could see on his face the realization that he's actually just been shot, you know, what he's done. You can see he's white, and he might be about to puke, and he's walking off. And there's other shots which give us a glimpse of the audience. Now, Christine Stiles does this beautiful take on how performance art becomes rarefied and different from normative ethical situations. Okay, so it's that second category we talked about at the beginning. Normative ethics is somehow displaced or can be displaced by performance art, because performance art is this artistic, if you like, poetic action that happens isolated, can happen isolated from the normative understandings of ethical behaviour. Now, if you use applied ethics to the situation, which is normative ethics in an applied specific context, audiences were illegal in not intervening, because they were witnessing someone being shot. Now, we know it was prearranged, but someone could have fallen over and knocked the marksman, you know, he could have been shot through the heart. What would have happened had Chris Burden been killed? You know,
what would have Chris Burden had arranged to be killed?
Yes. So in a way, those audiences, and it might still be the case, performance art or not, those viewers, the participants, if you like, were acting unethically at the time. And you could argue legally, using applied ethics, that they were.
And then this is the same thing which comes up in the Marina Abramovich performance, where she leaves the entire audience to decide what they do.
Yeah, and in fact, the one where she was stripped down and someone threatened her with a knife or a gun, a woman intervened. And stopped her. But you're relying on the other performers, we're calling them performers now, not audiences, to intervene and to act in what we'd call an ethical way. So it seems to me really interesting that performance art as a category has this ability to act in a vacuum. That because it's this activity, and I guess theatre is similar. You know, if someone is shagged on the stage, and I've talked to actors who have shagged on the stage for real, you know, we're talking about the proscenium arch, we're talking about an audience there. You know, I mean, is that having a shag, or is that acting, having a shag. And some actors will say, no, it's not the same as having a shag, because I'm in a relationship. I mean, this is me acting on the stage. And so both these examples are examples of how of how the performing arts, in this case we're talking specifically about performance art, can be treated somehow as outside of normative ethics. And this is an area where it seems to me that we're getting into a more philosophical discussion about the parameters of ethics, because there's discussions here about the time or the duration in which performance art happens, just as we can talk about the time in which poetry happens as a literary device. Mm. That these things, that the performance art, the Chris Burden performance, might be treated as something that happens outside, somehow outside chronological time, outside clock time, that is. It might happen in a kind of ontological time, and is that time somehow suspended from normative ethics? Now, and this I think is really interesting. I think that probably the audiences should have intervened, but I can see why they didn't. And
indeed.
I wouldn't have intervened probably
indeed.
Had I been there as a witness.
Again, it goes back to what you might call as a peculiar remit that performance art often tends to feel it has, not that it has a license for, but that it actually has a genuine and positive responsibility for, and that is to be contestatory.
And I had this experience with Santiago Sierra. I had this experience with him in an interesting way when for One Day Sculpture, curated by David Cross and Claire Doherty.
There was a lot of ethical issues there with people like Santiago Sierra, who ended up not making a project, but I mean, that in itself was incredibly complex. And I think he wanted to blockade Tapapa with 2,000 sheep. Yeah, I know, proposed it to.
Yeah,
that's what he was going to do with you.
Santiago Sierra wanted to let a truck full of sheep off into the downstairs foyer of St. Paul Street. And there was a situation where I was asked as chair of St. Paul Street to give permission for this to happen. And I turned them down. But it was just this interesting moment between Santiago Sierra and myself when it was just this face-off. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't do this. And he said, the artist is always right. You're making a mistake.
Yeah, and that is really interesting. The imperative of the artwork, or the imperative of this idea of the autonomous artist whose art work is everything.
Right. So it should be looked at, and he's, you know, it was close.
Mm.
And he had his Ray-Bans on, and it was just like, the artist is always right, you're making a mistake. And he turned and walked off, and I never talked to him again. Now, this to me is just, you know, I in a way I respect his right to say that, but I also think that I made the right decision, and I'd make that decision again.
Because if the artist is always right, where does that stop?
Yeah, exactly. So this is where performance art and artists and their kind of role as, see, I think he's engaging here with this role of sort of genius. I think it's a deeply outdated notion of what it is to be an artist. It's like the individual creative artist is genius and conscience of society. And I think despite the fact he's a very contemporary and perhaps interesting artist and very well known, I think he's engaging with outmoded ways of operating as an artistic individual and as an author. He's kind of like pre-Barthes in a way, pre-Roland Barthes. He's kind of working in the 1940s and 50s, you know, as a form of the individual genius who always knows best and who arbitrates society. And so if we're talking about performance and participation as a contingency of enactment, coming back to the Amelia Jones point, we can't operate ethically like that. We have to consider participants and performance and the context of performance at every step. Now, I can see he was probably doing that and realising that his action would cause harm, both in terms of the fabric of the building and in terms of day-to-day life of the people using the building, and in terms of the animals as well. And he was obviously just not interested in that, or maybe he was interested in it but just was willing for the harm to take place.
Maybe to put it another way, that that for us to be contestatory in a certain way with respect to normativity, to regulatory mechanisms, juridical structures, the ways in which we can legitimately do that with some positive effect is often in arenas that are acceded to or given a space to in the arts. And performance, perhaps more than other modes of practice in those arts, are more immediate. And so it is in those circumstances of performance art practices that often our audiences are subjected to a contestation of what they might consider to be an appropriate mode of engagement.
A strategy that's going to violate the norms is in a kind of really glib way, is just a sort of a conservative gesture. The most radical thing you can think of, whatever it might be, won't be any more horrendous than the world's crimes, and or more upsetting, or sort of, and it's a shuffling of the chairs, sort of just a rearranging of the room, it's a soup in the wagon, totally, it's entirely futile activity.
The more kind of devious side of me remembers Jacques Lacan saying, you know, the problem with our modernity is that it hasn't been able to invent any new perversions. Inventing perversions is the most difficult thing. And I think about Pierre Klosowski writing about Sade, and Klosowski is one of the best writers on Sade, and on the notion of integral monstrosity and perpetual transgression, and how integral monstrosity and perpetual transgression leads to incredible repetition and boredom. And so the limits aren't external limits as to what can I do, but internal limits in a sense as to all one will end up doing is repeating oneself if one thinks one is being truly transgressive. And you'll be caught up in a kind of miasma of your own boredom with what you're, and that is that for me is the limit so much. And it doesn't mean that, or let's try and imagine an external limit that we can exceed to prove Lacan wrong. I think what Lacan is saying is that getting back to this notion of the relationship between law and desire closes a circuit for us every time. And perhaps the notion of ethics that is the most difficult and intriguing is when Lacan wrote about the ethics of psychoanalysis, and wrote precisely about that that notion of the ex nihilo, the out of nothing that we always imagine ourselves to become.
I mean, you know, like John Duncan's work Blind Date. Do you know that work? It's where he procured a dead body. And he had, this was in the late 70s, you should know about this work because it's important ethically. He procured a dead body from over the border in Mexico, a young woman that had died. He had sex with the body, necrophilia, and then had a vasectomy. So the last potent seed that he had was in a dead body. It was one of the few artworks that was ever condemned in High Performance magazine. I think it's 79. He was a student and influenced by Chris Burden. But that work in itself is absolutely, I mean, that whole notion of the America versus Mexico, this procurement of a body that you can buy at a Mexican corpse, and all the ethics around that work is unbelievably rife. But some people have argued that that work almost fatally damaged performance practice into the 80s, and one of the reasons why performance had it became spectacular and much more Laurie Anderson, you know, Andy Sprinkle style work, was partly a rejection of the fact that the transgressive avant-gardism of performance had reached a point where for an artist to continually make breakthroughs in performance practice, it led to that work by John Duncan.
Well, clearly it can't enable murder and rape. You know, it can't enable and carry out things that are clearly seen as unlawful and immoral within a particular social context. But we're coming back to that beginning discussion about ethics because its relationship with the law is really unclear, because there are points where rape and murder are sanctioned by hierarchies and they're therefore in some respect lawful, but they might be at the same time deeply unethical. They are at the same time deeply unethical. Prepared to sort of make that stand on that one.
I think about John Duncan and a dead body can't give consent, and the ethics around that are so incredibly complex. But the revulsion that people felt for that work across the board, it certainly changed the course of performance practice. But I think you're right in saying that maybe that was one of those signature moments where a degree of ethical reflexivity probably came in to examine body art practices in the 70s, and people looked at it from a very different sense. And so we've never gone back there since that time, and I think that's partly because of the politicisation of performance practice in the 80s and a stronger feminist perspective coming to train, post-colonial perspectives, that all shifted gears in terms of performance. And I think maybe ethics has become, in performance practice, is partly about a kind of post-modernisation of the world in terms of our understanding of the complexities of difference and how those things unfold within cultural practice. Maybe in a way in the 70s we weren't thinking about that in the same sort of terms. So.
You know, maybe if Chris Burden's piece had played out in 2012...
Would the director have said, no, you can't do that? Or Abramovich's piece, would the director have stopped the whole thing
probably
before the audience member did? And, you know, at what point are they going to break sooner?
Well,
are they going to
I suspect that in Sydney art space today, with Abramovich in tears and being cut, you know, and shirtless, cut in trauma, I suspect that if I was a curator or director of that space, I probably would intervene before the audience member did.
Mm.
I suspect. And would we be any worse off because of that? I don't think so. I mean, it would just be that the story would be that the gallery intervened, you know.
It becomes really blurry when it comes to art performance, art-related performance, too. And, you know, what is ethically appropriate and inappropriate? When you've got someone like, you know, Marina Abramovich in the 1960s allowing people to do whatever they wanted with her, no, it was early 70s, sorry, in Object O, then it's just kind of, well, you know, someone stood there and was threatening, he was going to shoot her, and then the audience got into an argument over it, whether they should or shouldn't, and was it ethically right to or not to. It's kind of interesting stuff in a way.
And there are really fuzzy areas, I think. And I think they come up, and I think it doesn't surprise me you've chosen performance as a place where this would come up, particularly in post-object art, for instance. You know, what does it mean? How do we evaluate Yoko Ono's cut, where she puts herself in a place where people abuse her, or Marina Abramovich, where they put themselves in a place where they have made that decision that they could be abused, and people choose to participate by abusing or not abusing.
I think the Abramovich one's even more extreme. I think the Yoko Ono one, you talk about the cut piece that she did.
Yeah.
I think, to me, that never got out of hand in a way that the Abramovich piece got right out of hand. And I think it's one thing to invite people to cut your clothes. It's another to actually have a gun on a table or implements of violence on a table and giving agency to audience in a gallery to do something about it. So I think the Abramovich work is the most extreme artwork probably ever made. And I think anyone that makes performance works, it's always a touchstone for us, because we're aware of what transpired.
But yeah, the question of, you know, the performer putting themselves at risk is interesting, because in our society, suicide is illegal. So it's in some ways along those lines of, like, you know, we are encouraging this person, enabling them, in counselling terms, to, you know, be crazy and put themselves
at risk, you know, potentially death, and we're watching. But I mean, that's the whole point of it. It's pushing those boundaries conceptually, and the, you know, the fact that our culture and society is always setting those things up, and this person is embodying that, and that's what performance art does. It embodies the politics of the culture. So, you know, that's the transgressive kind of decision that a performance artist takes. I feel doing it myself, and you know, in that situation with her, it's like, it is, if you're really going to become a mirror to each other, it's very chicken and egg, you know. It's like, she's going, how far do people's sick brains want to go here, and they're going, well, how far do you want to go here, because this is your work and this is you.
Yeah, you know, you're giving us permission. You're not saying no. You're not saying, you're letting us do this. You're not saying no. You know, you've abdicated your responsibility, one would say.
And, you know, she presumably would go the whole way, because, you know, and someone would shoot her. And that would reflect on them, ultimately.
Yeah.
It wouldn't reflect on her, actually. And that's her point, you know, like, yeah, she set it up, but she didn't shoot herself, you know what I mean? And, yeah, like, that person that would shoot her would be like, oh, I shot you, it's like, yeah, you shot her, that's really psycho, you know? Why don't you give her a massage, you know, like, you could have done that, you could have done something nice, I'm going to make her a cup of tea, but you chose to do that, so... Yeah, that this, you know, is sort of showing what is actually okay in our culture.
I taught at Dartington in the UK, which was a great place, like the Black Mountain in America, which was a small creative arts college that had music, theatre and visual arts, and the fantastic performance work came out of there. Very early versions of Promenade and Site Specific, you know, in the 80s and even earlier. With a lot of durational and kind of heroic stuff going on. And I used to run this project, and all the students had to do a site-based piece in the grounds, somewhere around, and this place, it was the middle of nowhere, like with woodland and bush and whatever, you know, and old medieval farm buildings and whatever. And they were put into groups of about five, and they were told, go do whatever you want. I remember the first time I ran this. And this illustrates your point that you don't think about this until afterwards, you know. And then we were invited to go and see these pieces. Well, my God, the ways that these guys could put themselves and their audience in danger was beyond belief. It was absolutely beyond belief. There was one where we were invited to enter a room that was flooded with water, and this guy was holding an electric heater, a plugged-in electric heater. Oh. My heart, absolutely... This guy works in Chicago now. He works for he worked with Goat Island and with some really, you know, he's amazing. Here he is, 19 years old. And we're all in the water too, right? So we're all in the water. It was like one of those moments where you go, oh, my God. And I remember myself running from one direction through this water, and Tim Brennan running from the other to get this plug out. And thinking, right, note to self, next project. The next thing that happened was two students decided that what they needed to do was to leap from holding hands from the top of a one-story building. And they both didn't quite break their ankles, but they were on crutches, you know. They had made this decision to do this. In another one, there was a ring of fire that we had to step into. And this was some kind of zeitgeist, the kind of harm and heroism, the kind of heroic nature of performance. Was Marina Abramovich had run a workshop quite recently. Was it then or later that she did that? Out in Dartmoor, where people had got lost in Dartmoor and eaten bits of gold. You know, so there was this notion that to perform, you really... It had to be physically dangerous. And so at the end of that, we had to sit down and give the students a code of what they could and couldn't do in a performance. And we had to explain to them in the terms that when they were artists, they could do what they want, but whilst they were students, and this was something we were responsible for, then they had to negotiate with us. What was interesting was that this meant that they had to tell us what they were going to do before they were going to do it. So if somebody wanted to, and somebody did, wanted to crash two cars together, You know, they had to tell us, and we had to say, no, you can, you can't, or yes, you can. Of course, that's an issue for that kind of performance art, mm. because it's supposed to be completely spontaneous, and you don't know what's going to happen. There are,
and you know, it's supposed to contain physical danger.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So working out a way of ensuring that they didn't harm themselves and they didn't harm other people. And I could go through the list of the things that were done. I mean, this was an incredible learning space for me as a young academic, I have to say. People in the middle of rivers that we had to go out and rescue.
I think the example I always think of is Mike Parr, Mike Parr's durational performances. And ArtSpace cancelled one in the middle of it. They looked at him and said, you're physically not capable of continuing.
Right.
And cancelled it. You know, is it a curator willing to... You know, is chooses to support an artist in extremely physically challenging work, work which, as you're saying, the work, this kind of work that pushes bodies to the limits. Who calls where the limits are?
It's going to be a movable feast according to individual social context situation. I mean, the body art, endurance art, takes context to its limits like that. That for me is part of the performance. The performance didn't fail because ArtSpace Sydney intervened. That intervention was part of the participatory nature of the performance. It was part of the whole deal. And us recounting it now is a form of documentation about that performance. And for me, it makes it more interesting than less interesting because it shows that aspect that Mike Parr as an artist sometimes takes us to the limit of us thinking about what is ethical practice. And that to me makes performance more interesting. And also, you know, the nature of failure of some of these performances is part and parcel of what they're about. Failure is not a lack of success. You know, where performances and where performance art can fail to meet its so-called ethical responsibilities or even audience participatory responsibilities, I find it to be at its most interesting. It's like the question about failure. You know, I learn a lot more from my failures than I do from my successes. You know, I'm a different person because of my failures, I think, overall. And I apply the same thing to this realm of so failure and ethics would have an interesting relationship here, right? I'm sort of thinking this for the first time at the moment. Failure and the failure of endurance or body art performances to continue and the way in which failure tests out kind of ethical structures and their limits, I think, is really interesting. And we do learn so much from failure. And we learn a lot from how the shortfall in the face of ethics. We learn a lot from where we go wrong ethically. You could describe Mike Parr as having failed in that performance, but I wouldn't do that. I would say that him going to limits of his endurance and him perhaps being incapable of deciding whether to
stop or continue
is an aspect of his work. And he probably he's also working up against the institutional structures. So he's kind of depending on Nick Sutis to intervene at that point. So Nick Sutis is very much, as I said earlier, part and parcel of that endurance performance. And if he didn't, you know, if he didn't have the institutional context to put up against, the performance would be entirely different. It wouldn't be possibly as interesting a performance. If he did that in the street and it wasn't named performance art, well, the effect would be profoundly different, and probably it would rely on someone in the public to call an ambulance or something, or maybe nobody would do anything. I mean, there's plenty of street people sitting in their own urine at risk of electrification, probably. There'd be instances of that just playing out in culture. So again, he needs, there's that beautiful, beautiful comment in The Shock of the New by Robert Hughes, you know, where he says that a car laundry, a line of bricks in a car park, is a line of bricks. Okay, but the Rodin sculpture is a displaced Rodin. So the car laundry relies entirely, almost entirely, on the gallery context for its verification as a work of art. So that, yeah, Parr's performance relies on the ethical structures and limitations of the institution. And so, and its failure is pointed up by those limitations, and its failure is integral to its success. I mean, it's more powerful because it had to be stopped for me.
Yeah.
And probably for Pa.
What you describe is also this kind of belief or idea that underpins not all performance practice, but a lot of it around, you know, that it's not real, and that the encounter is not real without risk.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right, and it tests that. You know, and that's fascinating. And it hasn't gone away. I mean, there was there's a nice publication that came out of the either the National Museum of Ireland or the, you know, their version of MoMA in Dublin around performance art. I don't know if you know it. Amanda Coogan's got a really nice article in it. But I think this is where I saw it. The cover image is of a bloodied hand. It's what is performance art?
It's probably unleashed its hand.
Yes, it is. It's the bloodied hand, you know. And so the continual notion of real bleeding, because that's, you know, that's one of the definitions of performance art as opposed to theatre, is that in performance art, it's real blood. It's your blood, it's real blood. And in theatre, it's pretend blood.
I was in Vienna a couple of years ago, about 2005, and there was a retrospective exhibition on at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Vienna, which had only, I think, quite recently had been opened, and it was the exhibition of that body of work we associate with Hermann Nietzsche, but also with a range of other body artists who worked very much with auto mutilation, with Hermann Nietzsche, who did the works with the meat and cutting up carcasses and doing a lot of butchery and a lot of blood, and extremely provocative. And what they had, of course, was they were performances, so they had lots of documentation, lots of archival video and film of these performance works, and they were really, I mean, there's something about it's an Austrian disposition. I don't know, but maybe not. That's unfair. But certainly, if you mention the 1970s, I think particularly of that body of work that was extremely provocative, and I'm thinking also coming from Sydney of the legacies of somebody like Mike Parr, whose own performance works were extremely violent and violent to himself, but violent to himself in the name of the recognition of a violence that goes unanswered for, that we all condone because we don't say anything in other kinds of communities, in communities of marginalized and oppressed. So he's kind of doing a work that is not speaking on their behalf, but pointing to the silence or the acceptance we will have in watching him inflict enormous pain on himself. The acceptance we'll have of that in the name of something, and the way in which we reconcile ourselves to a violence that is widespread and visible, but we simply will not act on it. Okay, so what is the... I think for an artist who engages in work as difficult and violent and contestatory as that, and the violence, as I say, might not be physical where some of Mike's work is, but psychological violence or simply shocking or disturbing work, in one's performance work, one needs to, I think, reflexively and very carefully ask about what one's ethos is, that it is the responsibility to oneself, or should I say the responsibility to a community, begins in that situation with what is that responsibility to myself in doing what I'm doing. And how do I reconcile the violence with... And if it's simply spectacle, for spectacle's sake, then I think that artist needs to ask carefully about why they're doing that.
I mean, I think it's important. I think it's vital, actually, in the arts to have the element of risk, and because our whole society and world is not safe, you know, so art is allowed to reflect that or, you know, work with that, I feel, without being put through such intense rigour, obviously within reason, like you don't want to have someone hanging or, yeah, like I've had a few complaints. Wellington is always the one. From the bats, they banned knives and shows after my show.
I'm going to throw in here the Erzatz shooting that happened at ASA.
Yeah, which I was intimately involved with.
My time at art school was very much about an investigation of audience reaction to things that I did, I guess. Being young and probably, you know, wanting a certain amount of attention and all the rest of it, I often did things which were either shocking in nature or challenging, you know, in terms of how they pushed audiences. We locked people in squash courts for hours on end. Oh, good Lord.
Yeah.
And, you know things of this nature. And we'd been doing a lot of those types of performances leading up to the performance in question. And it was, so I think it came about a little bit as a, literally, how far can we push this? You know, what's the end extreme of this? And so logically it was, well, death, clearly. let's die. I laugh retrospectively for those involved. Obviously, not such a great experience, but
So this was Hadley Avril, who was a student at the ASA, and Panya, and it was a piece where Panya shot Hadley, and we presumed it was a blank, but it was a 44 Colt Magnum revolver, which was pretty big, and it sparked, and he played dead for a very long time. And then what confused it was the participants turned the lights up and said, and feigned a real catastrophe, and they said, it's gone wrong. And Elizabeth Grierson was the head of school at the time, and she went up, and Hadley remained playing dead.
There was a bit of exploration at the time around the role of the media and of film and things of that nature, what's real, what's not real, all those sorts of things, the whole simulacrum debate and da 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 da, and so we were pushing those boundaries. I mean, we literally hired a film crew. We hired the Shortland Street film crew to simulate death. We had $500. I don't know where we scraped that from, Padia and I, but we managed to scrape that together, and we literally called South Pacific Productions and asked them if they knew how to do these sorts of things. Sure enough, we managed to hire someone with a fake gun, fake bullets, all of the rest, the pads filled with blood that go on the inside and pop when you push a button. We hired the ambulance crew, we hired them all. We never did a rehearsal. We just literally created this sort of series of time-based skits that sort of all ended in a gun being drawn, and then sort of ended, and then went to the next skit, and so on and so forth, and then eventually she pulled the trigger, and kaboom. And the first thing I remember was actually there was sort of a deadpan silence, and then someone in the crowd laughed. And it was probably at that juncture that I should have got up, but we held it. And we held it for probably, well, clearly, a bit too long.
And then an ambulance was called, and I was the one that called the ambulance. So, and I was behind the counter of the ASA at the time, and the gallery had a counter and office behind it. And the ambulance person said, "Is the area secure?" And I realised, because Panya was an unusual student. She was a dominatrix, and she was an unusual student, you know, and not necessarily predictable. And I had to tell him on the phone that I didn't think it was secure, and I remember just sinking down behind the counter and sitting on the floor, and I began to go into kind of trauma. And then an ambulance arrived, which was a real ambulance, and it transpired in hindsight that it was a med student who was driving the ambulance. But for all intents and purposes, she was full on, she was all dressed up, it was a proper ambulance, and it arrived with its siren on. And they took Hadley away, treating him. So, I mean, you know, Baudrillard's notion of simulacra is on roller skates here, because by this time I had announced to the students that it was fake and that Hadley was all right. And when I saw him carried out to an ambulance, I had to revise my decision and tell students that were holding the doors open for the ambulance drivers and everything that I didn't know.
If we'd stopped at that particular moment in time, I think it would have asked the question without necessarily forcing people to believe. You know, it would have suspended their disbelief, which probably would have been enough and a little bit more engaging. It would have been like that bad dream thing, and then you wake up and like, oh, thank God. And that would have been enough. It would have given you a flutter. But we didn't. We were young. We carried it on. The dean fainted and cracked her head on the concrete. And I got wheeled out in a stretcher and taken away in an ambulance. And I remember when I got home, because I went back, Panya and I went back to my parents' house. My mother was sitting there and she was like, "What did you just do?" And I explained to her, and she was like, "Oh wow, you may have pushed this one a little bit too far."
And it was extremely traumatic. I had to be put on a brown paper bag, and I had to have medical treatment. And it was amazing. I can feel my blood pressure go up as I talk about it, you know. So it was not an episode that I'd like to repeat. And it's a very real one for me though, because it was a situation of deception. Because with the Chris Burden example, the audience knew
exactly
what was going on. It was a real gun. It was a real bullet. There was no doubt he was shot. Everyone knew. Now with the Marina Abramovich examples, everybody knows. You know, she lies in the desert, she gets covered in flies, she puts her own body at risk, she's naked in a doorway, bouncing against Ule and you know. And it's stated. The audience understands what the ethical parameters are, even though they're interestingly suspended from normative and applied ethics. Okay. Mm. So the case with Hadley is and the shooting at the ASA is an interesting one, because, and we were really angry about it later, and clearly within a university context, it seems to me in that case that a series of moral codes, which is an understanding, it's kind of like applied ethics within specific situations, had been broken, and that was the deception of what I'll call the theatre. And there was also a staff member who I won't name now, but there was a staff member who knew what was going to happen and didn't say.
Mm.
So you could argue here that there's a staff member and students who acted in performance art unethically within the university context and the ramifications that followed that.
In fairness to the individual, the tutor that we went through, there was no... he couldn't possibly have known how well we would have done it. I mean, you know,
he was just expecting some bodgy sort of,
you know, like this is some fake blood being splattered somewhere. Or I don't think
you're getting out a tomato thing.
Yeah, you know, I don't think anyone in their right mind, even us, I don't think we could have imagined that it could have gone so well per se. You know, in terms of its how real it was. So I think if I remember correctly, yes, there were questions asked. Like, what are you going to do? This. We gave answers, and that was, that was fine. I think most of the questions were probably more in the space of, conceptual practice. So, what does this mean in the context of what you're investigating, more than health and safety issues or anything of that nature?
We were told there was a press blackout. Okay, I was wrong. My flat phone rang at 7 a.m. woke me up with the press, you know, the next morning, and I had to say, "I'm sorry, I'm not willing to comment," and they just put the phone down. you know, so it was quite a lively situation.
Someone leaked it to the paper. I don't know who. I think it was a student. I got blamed for doing that. It wasn't me. I don't know who it was. I had Paul Holmes turn up on my doorstep. Yeah. I just basically, on the dean's advice, I just turned him away, and yeah, we had various news crews turn up.
Well, I think there was significant harm to the performers, because they ended up realising what they'd done in hindsight. They had to come back in because they brought in the chaplain. Were you there?
I missed it.
Oh, no.
I was upstairs.
Oh, no, you're upstairs.
Yes.
See, Hadley and Pania had to appear in front of us because we all got together, and they brought in counsellors, you know, trauma counsellors, the chaplain.
I remember, I have, you know, quite a dreamlike memory of it. What I remember was realising, almost sort of stepping out of my body a little bit in that space. You know, when you're being attacked by so many people, like quite harshly, you know, very emotively, albeit, you know, understandably. My defensive mechanism for dealing with that was to almost step out of my body and just watch, you know, watch everyone attacking me. I was almost like the fly on the wall. I can't remember if it was moderated or not, per se. I'm pretty sure it was. But I remember it being more a free-for-all of just abuse, basically. Who the fuck do you think you are? This isn't art. This is, you know, you arrogant wanker, da-da-da-da, you know.
I think the performers were affected. The audience was profoundly affected. I mean, I was traumatised. Elizabeth was traumatised. The staff member who knew about it in advance was definitely traumatised. There was a mature student with a heart condition who, you know, was very traumatised and could, in fact, have had a heart attack and died. So there's lots of, you know, I mean, because what we realised, we'd witnessed someone being shot. And in hindsight, they weren't. But for us, we were witnesses of an actual shooting at the time. Now, so that's the power of performance art, or performing arts in general. Although this is a particularly interesting situation, because if you go to the theatre and you're looking at proscenium arch and you're in the audience, you would know that that wasn't a real shooting. This was a real shooting.
Some of the tutors, you know, heralded that piece as being really great. Some refused to mark it. Some students thought it was great. Some never talked to me again. And that alone created really interesting discourse around these very issues, which... You know, isn't that what we're meant to be doing in an art context? So you could justify it,
yeah.
But still, at the end of the day, it hurt a lot of people. So you just have to ask yourself, as a person, do you want to be the sort of person that's going to be doing that? I don't want to be that person, so I'm not doing it again. But yeah, and then the aftermath, of course, was particularly interesting because of the different audiences that arose out of that. So there was the primary audience that, you know, were emotionally impacted by the performance, and then the secondary audience being the general public who read about it in the paper and heard about it, da, 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 and all thought, oh wow, that's amazing, because they didn't have to experience it firsthand. Just in terms of the absurdity of something like that taking place, I think, more than anything else. And watching those two audiences change over the months afterwards. The secondary audience had quite a large impact on the primary audience that saw it, and once their anger had sort of died away, it was it was a little less confrontational for me at school, but you know, there are still people today that hold it against me. But yeah, so then they shut down performance from happening. That was the sort of more difficult side. Basically, everyone suffered as a result of my actions or the institution's response to my actions. And I, you know, I can't say whether that was right or wrong, but it banned performance from art school for a year, basically.
Yeah.
I was a young and popular lecturer at the time, as you tend to be when you're young. You're just popular because you're young. But they felt terribly let down by me, that I was saying to them, I remember having this argument with this guy. He says, at midnight, I want to crash two cars together in the middle of a field. And I'm going, but you're going to kill yourself. And he's going, he's only 19, so he's got no concept of death, you know. But to him, the most important thing was that I was messing with the integrity of his piece. And all of them were saying, like, we are not going to tell you beforehand what we're going to do because this is ethical for us. Mm. It's the integrity of the piece is that we don't tell you. You come to the piece and you don't know what's going to happen. And in some senses, we're not 100%, we're working within this framework. We have an idea of where it's going to go. You know, most performance art is within a framework, a very carefully thought through framework, but it's not scripted. So to say to them, after we taught them this, right, we taught them this, so then to say to them, well, actually, no, we want to, you to forget all that, and we want to know if you're going to have a room flooded with water and you're going to hold an electric instrument, we need to know that you want to do that, and we need to tell you that you can't, or we need to tell you ways that you could do that safely. And for us, it was like, the discussion was, it was really straightforward to us. It was like, we can't let you do something that will kill you or other people or break you significantly. We could, you know, we did have pieces where people were self-harmed to a small amount within what we would say was not hospitalised, you know. So for us, the question was not whether the student might want to harm themselves or other people, but what constituted enough harm to be of ethical, if you like, import to a point where there had to be an intervention.
Yeah, I have definitely had gotten better at just having to, like, looking after myself on stage.
Yeah.
Because people can, again, also do anything they want to you. And I've invited that, and I've been surprised how little I've had back, actually.
Well, in most contexts, as we're finding in this discussion, but particularly in the university context, because we're in one now, and that's part of the context for our discussion, there'll be a negotiation where some aspirations about performance, some projects are going to be made different. They might be made more interesting because of it. Because the students and performance artists need to negotiate the perceived parameters and limitations of perceived ethical behaviour. This is part and parcel of who we are and what we do. I mean, in no part of our lives are we separated from ethical responsibility. No part of it. Every moment we're engaged with it. So in that sense, performance art is no different from our life concerns and our life responsibilities. So no, it's not possible for performance art. But the limiting of performance practice might make it more interesting. It might make performers consider things in different ways. It might point up the limits and the possible failures of performance, which in turn might make it more interesting. Because the failures, as we've said, are not signs of unsuccess. Use that word. Failure is not a sign of failure. Failure is interesting. But you need something to fail against.
But I do think now that maybe, you know, it's interesting to think that the backlash against performance practice, especially in the States in the 90s, the kind of culture wars, so-called culture wars, I think that in itself also created a hysteria around what one could and couldn't do. And I think maybe one could argue that there was a stretch too far the other way, that there became a kind of puritanism and a fear of any kind of difficult engagement with the body, like Ron Athey's work, where his blood from his body has been kind of elevated above the audience and he's HIV positive. And I think that was a particularly difficult work for people because of the fear of HIV and AIDS and the like.
Well, I guess, you know, as we all know from, as you point out, a lot of performance art's made its name through boundary pushing. But I don't think there's a lot of boundary pushing to be done with it in this terrain anymore, so to speak. Because what performance art has done, as has done a lot of other visual arts practices, is that it's given permission for artists to do almost anything.
I mean, it's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, you think of Chris Burden. I mean, the things that Chris Burden did, would a gallery allow somebody to do that now? You know, if and would he have told you that that's what he was going to do? You know, my mate's going to come in and shoot me. Oh, cool. That's great. Yeah, why not? Yeah, that, oh, that'll be interesting. Or I'm going to crawl over glass. So, do these things almost always? I mean, is that why performance art in particular was, you know, Marina Abramovich talks about, says, I'm 63 and I'm no longer alternative, you know, because she gets put on. Is that why it was alternative? You know, is that why it was so difficult to accommodate within the gallery system? Because of these kind of... And in fact, was that part of what it was... I would argue that's actually part of what it was trying to do, was to sit outside the commodification of art.
Yeah, I mean, but to even answer your question, I mean, we did actually have Andrei Strick come, and one of our concerns was, will this be a work where he bleeds?
Mm.
And actually then the second concern was, if it is, who's cleaning it up?
Yes, yes. And could they get Hep C from it? Could they get AIDS from it, you know? The health issues beyond his own health and whatever. And what a tedious thing for curators to have to think about. It's not what you're trained for.
I mean, and again, I think that there's a kind of conflict then within that as well, because the imperative of the ideology of art says that you must enable the fulfilment of the vision.
Yes. Otherwise, it's not the art. If it isn't as it was envisaged by the artist, it's no longer the art. It's something else, and therefore it's not even worth doing. You know, and I would feel that if somebody told me that I couldn't do the performance that I wanted to do. I mean, very simple for me. I would do it elsewhere. I mean, it because the thing that I would then be doing in the gallery would not be my artwork. It would be something else. It wouldn't be worth doing.
I think so. Well, it depends on your ethics, I suppose. If it's an ethics based on the religion of art, then it's kind of like, well, you can do anything as long as you're making art in that framework. But if you're not making art, then you can't do everything. I guess that's one, it could be one extreme.
So I don't think in response to the question about limits, it's a matter of trying to imagine what is the most outrageous thing we can do. I think it's a matter of asking... what in the agency that we do perform do we understand as what is fundamental to the responsibility for the other? That for me. And if the limit is the fact that in a Levinasian sense the other is perpetually strange to us, that is, the other is what we will never be able to make sense of truly, then that responsibility is to what we simply cannot know or make sense of. And that, to me, is an infinite responsibility. That, in that sense, there is no limit.
You know, I think ultimately, Melissa, it's about finding an accommodation between the ethics and the agency of the audience and the performer to be able to enter into a situation, a cultural environment, where a dialogue can take place that has the potential for profundity, that doesn't fundamentally damage the sense of well-being of either the performer or the artist. And I think that is a kind of ethos, I think, is something that I would hold on to. But where it's more complex than that is, how do we define those terms? What point does it shift from one stage to another? What is acceptable, what isn't?
And how, in defining these terms, do we kind of not preclude the possibility for transgressive interrogation?
Definitely.
That is also that question again, you know, at what point is it beyond transgressive and into outright...
exploitational.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a point. I think there's a serious... it's a liminal... mm-hmm. It's a liminal space there. And... I guess, how do we make those determinations? Well, I think artists are always pushing the edges to try and find out how and what and you know, where are the limits for this? And I think ultimately it comes down to the ethics and judgment of the artist to find an accommodation between transgression and the well-being of the audience member. And, you know, how do you deal with that? I think you deal with it over time through a series of tests and prods, and sometimes you go too far, sometimes you don't go far enough. And you know, the line that we're looking for in these works is incredibly finite between it. And for one person, the line is here, and another person, the line is there. I know shouldn't be doing miming work on a sound recording, but...
But also, the other question is, who is measuring that line? Mm. Or who is making the determination? You
Maybe we're idealistic in that we have an idealism that people are prepared to kind of take risks and to be pushed in ways that, and maybe it's a completely conceited kind of colonialism that we think people are prepared to engage with those levels with a view to learning more about themselves. Because that's why I do it. And if the audience is not interested in that, then what I'm doing is fundamentally not right.
It doesn't stop there. Because obviously visual arts exists in a discourse. Galleries exist in a network of discourses. They exist in networks of practices. Artists exist in networks of practices. They exist on YouTube notoriety. They exist in journal validation or justification. They exist in a kind of copywriting process. And let's take that word copywriting in its multiple homophonic kind of registers. A kind of writing as in discursive, that copies the work in some way in a legitimizing fashion and makes it right. And so there is a responsibility that starts with an artist asking carefully, what is my agency here? But equally, in those of us who engage with work and talk about it and do or don't confront the difficult questions with it, who condone a spectacle that doesn't itself load onto anything more profound, that don't question the institutional borders of the practices, that don't question the network frameworks of the practices, and that don't question or draw up or pull up the critics who themselves don't question enough, or the journalists who want to kind of piggyback on something in order to do something, and so on.